Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 964. This episode brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your dreams into a reality, Katie. Well, I guess not just you. I guess anyone listening could probably
anyone
do this
can
too.
Do it, yeah.
Showcase your work or publish a blog or publish some content, sell some products online, services, if you will. Have an event page, whatever your special project is. Squarespace does this by giving you beautiful templates, powerful e-commerce. You can customize the look and feel and the settings and the products with just a few clicks. And everything's optimized for mobile right out of the box. There's built-in SEO, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. So a dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet, so make it a reality with Squarespace. Check out squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast. There are tickets on sale for my show at the Neptune October 26th. I believe we're adding a second show. We're adding a second show because the first show did well enough. So I guess there's going to be a second show. Let's go for a third show. But I really do want to have like a fun sort of a Halloween themed show. So I will probably be in costume. I will most likely try to bring Mike Furman and Abel Richardson and force them to wear costumes. And you should wear costumes as well. So spend your Halloween weekend with me in Seattle at the Neptune Theater, October 26th. Second show added. Go to Ticketmaster.com for tickets. Katie, what do you have on the ID10T corkboard?
Judy Garnett writes, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in the middle of 2010, had a double mastectomy in November of that year. I went through four rounds of chemo, lost my hair, the whole shebang. Now with my four-year chemoversary coming up on June 18th, I'm spearheading a haircut-a-thon to have people come and get a new hairstyle for summer. All the hair will be going to High Lifeline that helps kids with cancer and their families. It only takes 12 inches of hair, and all hair types are accepted. It's going to be in Santa Monica on June 18th. From noon to 4 p.m., you can reserve your spot by emailing raejeanna@ouidad.com. And the best part, it's all free, both for the people donating their hair and the kids that are getting wigs. Also, Jennifer Elwell writes, I volunteer for a wonderful dog rescue in Northern California called NorSled, short for Northern California Sled Dog Rescue. Based in the Bay Area. We specialize in helping out huskies, malamutes, other northern breeds and mixes. Unfortunately, breeding sled dogs has become very trendy, and shelters and rescues end up full of huskies when people don't fully understand how smart and active they are. But with proper stimulation and exercise, they can be the most affectionate and loyal pets you can ask for. We have adoption fairs at local pet stores every Saturday in the East Bay, and you can check out our event schedule and all our available dogs on our website, norsled.org, or follow us on Instagram at norsledrescue. We are always looking for fosters, volunteers, financial support to help for the dogs.
Excellent. Thank you, Katie Levine. Those were very nice.
I know. I liked them both. I thought they were good.
Katie Levine, who's wearing her Flight of the Mother Flippin' Concords t-shirt. I love that shirt.
I saw them at the Greek, and it was like an amazing show.
Might have to go get that. I might have to go online and try to find that shirt somewhere. This episode is my friend Howie Mandel, who is rad. What a great guy. You know, we met, I guess, judged AGT last season, and it was incredible. And now Howie and I totally hit it off, and he came and did At Midnight. And our showrunner, Jack Martin, on At Midnight was also his producer on Deal or No Deal. And Howie's, you know, he's someone that I always was a fan of because he's such a fun, great joke writer, and he's so fun to watch on stage.
Yeah.
And the thing that's so great about him is that he is also willing to be open and vulnerable and talk about, because obviously he has OCD. Mm-hmm. And so he talks a lot about it. And he was just very open and very honest about the whole thing. And on top of that, getting to talk about comedy and sort of the history of comedy with him, it was an absolute, I mean, I feel like I always bend his ear about this kind of stuff, and he's always very gracious about it. But I really, really, really enjoyed chatting with him for this episode. I went to his offices very far away from where I am. I would drive anywhere for that guy. I would drive anywhere for you, Howie Mandel. AGT, or America's Got Talent, as people who are abbreviophobic. Does that make sense?
Abbreviophobic?
Yeah, you just don't like abbreviations.
I get it.
Yeah. Initialism. AGT is initialism. Because you're using the initials of AGT. AGT, May 29th, which has already happened, so it's on NBC. Watch America's Got Talent. God, last year was so much. It was so much fun, and I'm excited about this year. It really is one of those shows where you just have your mind blown by people who focus on a talent or a thing, and even if they don't nail it, it's not an easy thing to do.
They're still getting up there in front of these judges, in front of like America, and they're trying.
They are, and I also feel like it doesn't even matter what your talent is. Like, I've seen stuff kill on that show where you're like, wow, someone discovered that they could, I don't know, make a stage play out of cantaloupes and then eat the cantaloupes while in the middle of a stage reading of a play. I'm making this up. But the point is, it should show you that you can have a thing, whatever your thing is.
Yeah.
That show can inspire you to like just pursue that, whatever that weird thing is, to the fullest, and you can be the best at that thing. So I genuinely enjoyed doing it, and Howie was great, and Mel and Heidi and Simon too, like just so cool and nice, and it was a real pleasure to get to be involved with it. And so this episode's Howie, and it was also brought to you by Mattress Firm. Mattress Firm, you love lounging on your couches as much as the next person, but when do you binge watch TV or scroll through social media and listen to favorite podcasts? You do that in your bed, usually. I mean, I feel like that's where Lydia and I spend most of our time, by the way. Because when you come home after a long day, it's like, yeah, it's just nice to kind of already be in bed. So if your mattress sucks and it's lumpy or old or crappy or whatever, it's affecting your sleep, then you really need to upgrade that. And Mattress Firm wants to help you. They'll even deliver your bed right to your door, and they'll take away the old one. They have incredibly low prices, and you're not going to spend a ton of money like a millionaire would. Use the code ID10T for 10% off your purchase at Mattress Firm. Go to mattressfirm.com/ID10T to learn more. Shop online or in store with more than 3,000 stores around the country. They can offer you deals that others can't. And they're in your neighborhood, ready to help, and they want you to start sleeping better. So go to mattressfirm.com/ID10T and use the offer code ID10T to take your 10% off. But this offer won't last long. Hurry! Also sponsoring this episode of the podcast, Felix Gray. All right. You spend a lot of time in front of your computer. You're at work. You're at home. You have your phone up to your face. You have your computer up to your face. You have your video game system up to your face. You're staring at the screen, and that is exhausting. You can get digital eye strain, which is a legitimate thing, where you get eye fatigue, dry eyes, migraines, blurry visions, etc. It can be hard to concentrate. But when you protect your eyes with a beautifully designed pair of Felix Gray computer glasses, you can keep doing the things that you love to do. Felix Gray's lenses are specially designed to filter blue light and eliminate glare from screens, which are the two main culprits behind digital eye strain. They have blue light filtering technology embedded into the lens, so they're effective without the yellow tint or the color distortion that other blue light filtering glasses have. They really spend the time to make these right. Felix Gray's frames are handcrafted from premium Italian acetate, the same material used by the biggest designer brands in the world, and they're very stylish, and there's no prescription necessary. Their glasses are available in non-prescription readers, and they just launched prescription lenses, so everyone can benefit from wearing a pair of Felix Gray's. All orders are free shipping and free return, so you have literally nothing to lose. Go to felixgrayglasses.com, felixgrayglasses.com/ID10T to try a pair of Felix Gray glasses today. That's felixgrayglasses.com/ID10T. Thanks for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast, which is Howie Mandel. Katie, roll it.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
We're deep in valley territory.
Is this weird for you to be this deep in the valley?
No, I feel okay. I feel okay. I think I'm going to be okay this far in the valley. I have GPS now. I think I can figure out how to get back home from here. I'm looking at the St. Elsewhere caricature.
Yes. Yeah, can you... Well, I'm in the middle.
Yeah, you know, that was when I really started to realize, because in my head, comedians were comedians, dramatic actors were dramatic actors. And that was kind of when I started to realize, oh, yeah, people can do all sorts of things. They don't have to just be comedians.
You know what? But for me, the pursuit, getting Saint Elsewhere, which if anybody is of the, it was in the 80s,
yep.
the early 80s. It was a drama.
Mm-hmm.
It was like Hill Street Blues.
But a medical drama.
A medical drama run by Bruce Paltrow, Gwyneth's father. I was pursuing comedy. So what happened was I got an HBO special. I did a Young Comedians HBO special.
I remember it.
It was me and one of our alumni just passed away this week. Harry Anderson just passed away. Me, Jerry Seinfeld, Richard Lewis, and there was a couple of other people, Harry Anderson, on it. And having come to the next level, what I believe was the next level of my career, I was selling out in theaters. I said, everybody moves from stand-up comedy to a sitcom. So I went and my agent set up a general meeting for me at MTM, Mary Tyler Moore, yep. which was predominantly known for sitcoms, though they did have Hill Street Blues on the air. And I had a general meeting with this young lady, Molly LaPata. I'll never forget. She was the casting. And I went in for the meeting, and it was in deep in the valley also, right at Radford Studios. And I introduced myself, and I had done comedy. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, sitcom might be the way to go, and maybe I can do my, just play myself, but in a sitcom. And she said, well, can you act? And I said, I don't know how to answer that. I don't know. I mean, you tell me, can I act? So she said, read this. And she gave me the a side, a piece of a script. And I read it. And it was all this medical jargon. I didn't really even understand what was coming out of my mouth. And she said, that's very good. Could you come down the hall? And I said, yeah, I'll go down the hall. And I go down the hall, and there's this broke into a meeting. Now I know it was like Mark Tinker,
mm-hmm.
whose father owned MTM. Grant Tinker was married to Mary Tyler Moore, and running the network. And Bruce Paltrow, who I didn't know, and some other people who went on to do huge things. And she said, read this for them again. So I read that same thing. And this is on a Friday. And halfway through the reading, they went, fine, thank you. And I left. And I went home, and my wife said to me, how did that go? And I go, well, it didn't seem to go well. but that being said, it wasn't that funny.
Right.
Because I had no context. I didn't know what I was reading. And I was reading all this medical jargon. Within minutes of getting home, they said, could you come back? I got a phone call from my agent saying, could you go back, but go right into Burbank, go to Brandon Tartikoff's office.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. So I got in the car.
The head of NBC at the time.
Yes, the head of NBC and probably one of the giants of all broadcasting. He made TV what it is today everywhere. But anyway, at that time, it was just Brandon Tartikoff. He was just the president of the network at the time. So I go there, and this is still on that Friday afternoon, when I get there, they lead me into Brandon's office, and in Brandon's office was the same group of guys that were in the office at MTM, and they said, could you read this, that same thing for Brandon now? So I read that same thing, and they went, could you just wait outside for a minute? And I said, all right, and I left the office. I had no idea what was happening. And then they all walked out, and they went, very good. And I go, thank you. Thank you very much. And I went home. I'd like to say somebody called me in the car, but there weren't even car phones.
We didn't have that then.
We didn't have that. And I go home, and my agent called me and said, congratulations, you start Monday. This was a Friday. And I say, I start on what? And they said, well, you've been cast in St. Elsewhere. And I go, well, it's not funny. It's not funny. And I was cast as Fiscus. Now, I don't know that people know this. I ended up for 6 years. This is a show where Denzel Washington came out of. I replaced somebody. They had been shooting for 5 days, and they shut it down, and they recast.
Oh,
I'm not the original Fiscus. The original Fiscus went on to win an Academy Award. His name is David Paymer.
Oh my God. David Paymer?
David Paymer.
Holy shit.
Was let go, and then I replaced him. as Fiscus. I always felt terrible when I knew it was David Paymer, but then he did really well.
And it all worked out okay.
He did okay.
Yeah, and David, he worked out just fine.
Mr. Saturday Night was an Academy.
He was in Quiz Show, too.
He was in Quiz Show, and Mr. Saturday Night, he played Billy Crystal's brother.
Yep.
And that's, he got nominated for an Academy Award, I think, for that part.
Oh, man.
And then, so I went on, and for 6 years, I worked alongside Denzel. And to this day, Denzel will call me from the set saying, "Howie, how would you play this scene?" So I know people think.
So it was a lifelong relationship that you forged, and we're now you've ultimately. I mean, I don't. I guess you're responsible for Denzel's career is a grand statement, but you know, but you contributed a lot to.
Well, no, I think I'm responsible, and I also think that when people are watching any movie that Denzel is a part of. You're really seeing a piece of me.
Well, I know in the book, and when he did the Book of Eli, he was blowing up a glove on his face, and I thought that was a very bold choice, you know, to take that.
Thank you.
To take that.
Thank you.
St. Elsewhere is an amazing show because it was such a fixture of 80s television.
Right.
And still one of the most talked about finales, I think, if for people who know the history of television, that the entire episode they suggest is in the mind
of an autistic
child who's looking at a snow globe with the hospital.
Right.
And so the reason that that is very impactful is not only because it sort of explains the whole series of St. Elsewhere, but if you follow all the crossovers that happened during St. Elsewhere, because I think Hill Street Blues probably crossed over. There were a couple shows that would cross over occasionally.
Mostly other shows that have, like, things like that that had already been done. Like, they were crossing over and using same character names of people in The White Shadow, and which was his previous show.
Right, so that means that all of those shows were also, by proxy, in the mind of this child. So that this child basically imagined all of these hit television shows because they're all part of the same universe.
For all we know, this whole podcast is inside the mind of an autistic child.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's 100% what's happening.
You're right.
But, you know, you also mentioned the Young Comedian special. And I remember, let's see, Saget's was the ninth. Right. The one that Saget and Louis, you were the sixth, because that was a few years before.
Right.
And I guess it's hard for people now who don't really understand what that meant back then, but when there were really only a handful of outlets at the time, a handful of channels, that Young Comedian special made comedy stars. I mean, it really defined the comedians. Like, when you go back and look at all those early ones, like, pretty much everyone from those went on to become comedy stars.
You know, the difference between starting as I did, I started in the 70s, but and starting today is, well, maybe you can, I guess, on digitally, you can blow up overnight and become viral. But I don't even know that that really changes your life. You know, in the days when I was coming up, there was, you know, three networks. And then, you know, there's four channels. They ended at, you know, they signed off.
Yeah.
TV signed off. I remember seeing the national anthem and the flag going, or in the morning, if you got up early, you saw a test pattern. So if you were lucky enough to be part of anything on television, you're the next day, your life was different. You know, your recognition factor went up. And then if you did something like a Young Comedian special or a Tonight Show, any one of those two, it was like you were just catapulted into a whole new world. And I was, when I did the Young Comedian special, you know, I shot it at the Roxy, here on Sunset Strip, and I didn't know anybody or anything, and I shot it and it aired. I was casted by the producer on it was George Carlin's wife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she gave me the job. You know, every night at the Comedy Store is where, you know, we all had like our home base, whether it was the Comedy Store or whether it was the Improv at that time. Every night at the Comedy Store, you didn't know who was in the audience. You know, she was happened to be there. I wasn't showcasing to be on a Young Comedian special. She saw me and right there said, "You'd be perfect for this special that I'm one of the HBO specials." And being from Canada, well, even at that time, I didn't even realize what that meant. I thought that meant I got a job. You know, I didn't realize how life-changing that job would be. And that job really, legitimately, it was like night and day from the time HBO started airing that. And HBO, even at that time, had a fraction of subscribers and viewers that they probably have today.
Right.
But it meant so much to be on these shows. It's just a different world today. You can be on TV
It doesn't matter. Yeah, being on TV, people are like, hey, who gives a shit? I have more Instagram followers than your TV show. Okay, all right. You know.
Right, but I think because of reality television and because of the way we are and because of the internet, being broadcast someplace doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And to this day, nobody's more thankful than me when somebody comes up and they know my name or they recognize or they say that they like something that I did or they remember. I can't tell you what that means to me because for the most part, I walk up to somebody and you probably because you're like a little encyclopedia in your head. But, you know, a number one show is NCIS.
Right.
You know, can you, aside from Mark Harmon, because I worked with him on Sane Elsewhere, can you name the stars of NCIS? You probably can.
No, I haven't. Well, let's see. There's Lady McFeely and Tomston, and I think those are just those two.
Okay, so but my point is, on broadcast television, in any given week, they probably have 15 million viewers. It's probably the number one, you know, scripted show on broadcast television. And the fact that you don't even know their names.
Yeah.
You know, I just remember that in the 70s, if somebody was on TV, you knew their name. Even if you didn't watch the show.
It was a big deal.
In fact, you know who Donnie Most was.
Yes, of
you
course.
Know, Donnie Most. But what I'm saying is you watched Happy Days. You knew what the third character's real name was and what he did in life. Today, you have no idea. It doesn't matter.
But isn't that interesting, though, that even with that you ended up working on a show that exposes new talents to the world? Because people who crush on AGT, you know, there are clips that go viral and people really do know who they are. I mean, like with almost overnight, that actually weirdly does happen on AGT, because that clip that I was on from the show I was on last year with Angelica Hale and I gave her the golden buzzer, people talk to me about that in public a lot. And people really do watch that show as a way to discover new people.
And here's they do. But I also think that in the last 3 years, we have opened up to the internet much more than any traditional broadcast television has. You know, the Golden Buzzer the winner of last year, Darcy Lynn,
mm-hmm.
her Golden Buzzer, because we, as you know, and you've been part of this, we pre-tape the auditions. Her Golden Buzzer already had, they release it online and on YouTube and on Facebook and on the, she had 10 million hits before our show aired. But then pieces of that, so they watch that. So I think that broadcasting it along with what's happening on the internet is making our show and those people much more prevalent in as far as having information, knowing their names and than any other show. Plus, we are the only bastion of variety television there is, and the only bastion of not just a game show where people can win money, but where people's personal lives and dreams change right in front of their eyes. You know, I'm surprised that there aren't more variety shows on television.
Well, they're hard to make because there are so many. When a show really works and it feels very seamless, it's easy to take for granted. Like, that's easy. They just throw a bunch of people up there and then they got the judges. But there is for anyone who's ever made a television show knows that a successful show is a delicate chemistry of all the moving parts of the directing and the lighting and the music and the social media team and the people who are guests on the show and the hosts on the show and the concept of the show, that it's, you know, several things have to go very right in concert with one another for a show to be a hit. It just isn't. It isn't an accident, and it isn't an accident for it to continue to be a hit and to grow. And so, it doesn't surprise me that there aren't more variety shows on, because they're just fucking really hard to make. Like, a really good one's really hard to make.
Right, and I think that they cracked the code on AGT, but I think that there should be more people trying. You know, it's kind of amazing, because every year, I think, you know, we've seen it all. And then just when you think you've seen it all, you realize you ain't seen nothing yet. And you realize how deep this pool of talent is. And I think that almost everybody, and probably anybody listening to this, really has a talent. But I can't remember who said it, but 99% of making it is just showing up. And every year we have these people that just show up. And whether they show up and they think of these things that are so out of the box, like I was watching the two nights ago, I don't think you were at this one. Did you see the Diablo Mochi?
I saw the Diablo guys.
No, the guys. I'm talking about Guy.
No.
So the this guy Mochi, so he's got Diablo, which is, for those that don't know, it's that little
it's
yo-yo.
It's like a big juggler's yo-yo, basically. It's
a, yeah, on a, yeah. On a string.
On a string.
But he did it in front of a projection screen where he did these amazing graphics that were programmed exactly in time with his routine. So he had to follow what was on the screen. At the same time, he's tap dancing while he's got, you know, these lasers in the dark. I mean, just the concept of coming, you know, I'm going to tap dance and I'm going to create graphics and I'm going to do the Diablo. How does this all come together? And I'm fascinated with the fact, not only seeing the act ultimately, but why? How did you think of that? Why did you?
That's a great point, because it, you know, I always go back to this quote and I always fuck up the quote, but I think you'll appreciate the gist of it. I've said it a lot on the podcast, but it was a Bill Hicks quote, and it was sort of in the idea that, you know, the more yourself you are, the less competition you have. So it basically means the stronger your voice is, the more unique you are to yourself. There's no one else like you. So you take a guy like that, who probably is interested in tap, he's interested in graphics and lasers, and he's interested in Diablo, and he must have realized, oh, I love all of these things, I'm going to mash them all together. And so what you get is a completely unique thing, because it's very much a part of who he is. So you're not just watching a guy do a talent act, you're watching a guy do a very, you know, in real life representation of who he is and what his soul is. And I think that's part of the magic. And because it's so authentic to who he is, it's better than just watching someone who's very technically proficient just do the technically proficient thing.
Well, you know, speaking of philosophy, that is the best philosophy. You know, it's about just doing it and not doing it and not thinking. You know, I think that most people, aside from this business, think about, you know, they put themselves together, they say things because they think that this is, you know, how people might want to perceive them, right? If I'm the president of the bank, I got to dress a certain way, I got to act a certain way. They're all about how other people are going to perceive them. If you look at the people that really make it in life, and I'm not talking about in show business, but show business is a great, you know, example of it. There are people that kind of exactly what you said. We're kind of intuitive and we're still taking calls.
Hello.
Yeah, so I was just calling in to tell you the names of the actors on NCIS. You guys really dropped the ball on that one.
Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have time.
Okay, I understand. Click.
That was good.
Oh, thanks.
That was
totally I didn't know we were taking call-ins, but you know, you got to roll with it.
That is.
Yeah.
And we'll put up a tote board. How much have we raised so far?
$0, Howie. We've raised $0 so far. Phone lines are still open. $0 so far.
But I'm saying you're a perfect example of this. Being true to yourself. You know, you're the Nerdist. You're the guy that was interested. Number one, you're interested in comedy. Number two, you're interested in like science fiction and all these comic books and all these other. Look at your career. Your career just became what this little nerd kid. No, but and you're phenomenal at it.
Oh,
but
thanks,
that's
man.
But that's the exact same. That's the same thing as you were just speaking of. If you can, for me, it was an impulse. I did not pursue this business. Everything I've ever been punished for, expelled for, hit for is what I seem to get paid for today. I don't have a GED. I could not stay in school. I was asked to leave many schools because of behavioral problems. I went in the mid 70s to a comedy club. I'd never been to one.
Yuck Yucks?
Yuck Yucks in Toronto. And it happened to be the MC came on and said, if you want to try this, you know, Monday nights, and somebody I was sitting with went, you should do it. I went, okay. No thought to what I was going to do. And I just did it. And I'm just myself. And who would think that what was perceived as a problem as a child would become a career as an adult? But you realize that if you don't think about it and you don't plan, or you just, you be you, you know, there is something to be said. And there is something about humanity that just is such a beautiful treasure of, you know, I had this friend, Denny Dent. Do you know who Denny Dent was?
I don't think so.
Denny Dent passed away, but he was the first guy that you probably saw him on television. He used to do those speed paintings with two hands. He was at Woodstock, and you know, the Rolling Stones would play, and in one song he could get a perfect painting of Mick Jagger on a giant canvas. Did you ever see that on
TV?
No,
but it sounds amazing.
So write some music with two hands, and he became the kind of the motivational Bill Gates motivational entertainment for his company. And he talked about how he didn't know he found this talent within himself, but he wouldn't think about painting with both hands, no brushes, in 6 minutes. It just, he did it one day out of his whole, something emotional came over him and made him do it. And his point was, we're all artists. You know, you think of an artist as somebody with a paintbrush and some paint, but we're all artists. And I don't care if you're answering the phone, and I don't care if you're cutting somebody's hair, or you're a secretary, an accountant. The creative juices of just being a human and going by our instinct and finding new and exciting and different ways of doing things. And you don't have to look for that, but just being yourself. If you embrace that, you're going to, you know, tread new ground that has never been
done before. No matter what the discipline is or what you're doing, you can be creative about anything.
Right. And but I mean, Columbus got on a boat, which he thought was a, you know, and it's just pushing the boundaries. He didn't care. As far as anybody was concerned, the world was flat.
Right.
Right. But he was going to prove, but he had no way of proving, but he just felt, it's just, he had to do it. And you just got to go for it. And you got to be without fear. You just got to be you. You got one life, and everybody's living their life for everybody else. You know, on stage, I don't do what I think you're going to think you're going to laugh at. I do what makes me laugh.
Right. Well, and that's why one of the reasons why I always loved your comedy whenever I would see you on any of the million stand-up specials that populated television in the 80s was that it became stand-up became such a business in the 80s in terms of being able to make comedy stars so they could tour or get a sitcom or whatever. And so there were a lot of guys who followed the set-up punchline joke. And I always loved watching you because you had this sort of persona of like, oh, I'm like a class clown who just has fun on stage and fucks around because it's silly, no matter what it is. And you'd play with the audience, you'd do prop work, you'd tell jokes, just like any avenue to be fun and entertaining on stage. And your comedy special where you went through the mall is genius.
Thank you. You know, the truth is, and it's all subjective, you know, as much as you might think that's genius, the other people think, why was I even given a dollar to do a special? But and I believe that, you know, and I also err on the negative. I'm a glass half empty guy, even though my persona is kind of joyful and everything. But I mean, I remember on the height of my career as a stand-up comic, I'd sold out two nights at the Radio City Music Hall, and I was standing in my dressing room in between shows looking out onto 7th Avenue there, and 7,000 people are you know, piling out of the theater as 7,000 people are piling in for the next show, and they're cordoned off the street, and there's cops, and it's New York City. And my wife goes, isn't this amazing? You don't look like you're happy. And I thought, well, you know, this is 15,000 people or 14,000 people in a city of 10 million, you know, so ultimately 9,985,000 people don't give a shit that I'm here.
So if we're looking at the numbers, right, it's actually not
that
impressive.
But what I was saying was when you talk about comedy, you know, you go to an amateur night and you watch somebody on stage and it's just, you know, there's nothing more uncomfortable than silence.
Right.
And somebody just struggling really hard. And you go, well, why is this person... like, what made this person? Nobody's there of their own volition. Everybody's there because one other person at a dinner table or in their house or their roommate go, you're funny, man. You gotta do that on stage, you know? And they get up and they do it. And as luck would have it, that sensibility doesn't translate to more in their buddy that told them to get up.
Not always. They have to find that on stage.
But I think there is a big part of luck involved that my sensibility or your sensibility, my sense of humor translated enough so that a handful, like a room full of people, will laugh. And if you could touch the funny bone of more than people just at the Thanksgiving table, if you have that ability, then kudos to you. Whether I get the joke, whether I like the joke, and I always felt like within the comedy community, it's kind of evil. Like when you talk about props, you know, people put one comic will put down another comic because he just does.
Oh, it's a prop comedy. Oh, it's a guitar comic. Oh,
and you know, and people have been, you know, I'm friends with Scott Carrot Top.
Yep.
You know, and he has been the butt of some internal jokes by comedians. He'll say that, not respected. You got to respect that man because he not only, you know, creates his own act, builds his own props nightly in Vegas. That room is roaring. And if that room is roaring, they can't be wrong.
You know, first of all, I'm not a comedy snob in that way. I don't begrudge anyone whatever tools they use because everyone's different. I think for Carrot Top, I honestly just think it was his name that people would go, oh, Carrot Top, you know, because it's a silly sounding name. If he just went by, oh, if it was Scott Thompson, the guy who does who also is the same name of the kid as the Kids in the Hall guy, I don't think he would have gotten as much shit, you know. I think it was the name. I think it was the crazy hair and the name that people sort of looked at him as like, oh, he's like a clown. He's like the clownish side of stand-up, and I talk about real shit. And it's like, well, so what? That's your tool set, and that's his tool set, and but no one's wrong.
But it's all subjective. It's like,
of course,
saying,
it is.
You know, like, whether you like country music, whether you like classical music, whether you like EDM, or whether you like pop, one isn't that is a style of comedy. But his brilliance, and he's brilliant, he's much more successful than 9 out of 10 of the people that are, you know, shitting on him.
I love him, and I don't have any...
But I had that too.
Yeah,
I was shit on too. I was the guy that, you know, people write their, you know, political satire, and I would show up and pull a rubber glove on my head. And they go, well, what is that? And why is he being booked or selling out a theater? And I'm writing. I sit for hours and hours and hours and go through the paper and talk about what's happening, and, you know, and this idiot shows up and puts a rubber glove on his head.
Yeah, but they're also underscoring, again, it's sort of like looking at, similar to what I was saying about looking at a show like AGT, a successful show, and going, oh, well, that's not hard. It's like, yes, it is. I mean, putting the glove on your face to someone who thinks that going through the newspaper is somehow more valuable, they're discounting the fact that it's authentic to who you are. You figured out how to do it, make it connect with an audience. Like, it's not that it's not work. It's just different. It's just different. And you can't say that, you know, because I've struggled sometimes on the road early on. I struggled with writing wordier jokes. Oh, this is so much more meaningful. I'm like, nah, people just want to have fun. And if you're a guy that can write wordy jokes and that's fun to you, great. And if you're a guy that can stretch a glove over your face or pull tiny phones out of a chest on stage, it doesn't matter. Like, an audience just wants to connect with the person on stage. They want to forget about their lives for an hour and just have a good time. So to me, it doesn't really matter how you go about doing that.
You know, for me, comedy is mining. It's finding it. Like, I don't buy it. I mean, I've had writers, but I mine it. I don't know. Like, if you would have asked me the night before I put on the glove on my head whether that is funny, I would have said probably not. Is anybody going to laugh at it? Probably not. Would I plan on trying it? No. That came out of a moment, and this is indicative of how most of my comedy has come to me. I, you know, I'm a well-known germaphobe, and I have OCD. I carry rubber gloves with me. I have for decades. And I was on stage with nothing to do. And that's how my act started. I was a very – like, I never thought of the ramifications. From the time I got dared to go up, I didn't plan anything.
So when they were like, okay, you have to do an hour, you're like, shit, what am I going to do for an hour?
Well, it wasn't even an hour. It was like 5 minutes. So I would show up. If you look at old tapes, if you go to YouTube and you look at old tapes of me, I'm very different. I seem to have somewhat of a different persona, but not really. You're looking at a terrified young man who is ill-prepared. And that's what it was. So I would, they go, ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel. And then I would walk out, and in the moment, I'd go, okay. And that was my act. All right. Something's going to come. Okay. And then you see how you're laughing?
Well,
I didn't
getting,
under, no, no, no.
Getting but, the backstory on that's amazing.
But that's what it is. So I go, okay. And no, but I'm saying you'd laugh and people would start laughing at me like that. And I go, what? No, tell me, really. What? Okay. Oh, okay. All right. And that became my act. And I was the guy that people thought I was on drugs. I wasn't on drugs. I was scared shitless with nothing to say. And okay. All right. And I put my hand in my pocket and there's my rubber glove. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. And I'll just pull it over my head. And I started breathing and I realized the fingers started moving and they were laughing. And I go, what? And then I started blowing it up with my nose and it popped off and everybody applauded. And in my mind, I'm thinking, really? Is this a what God. The fuck is this? And that really, that moment bought me a fucking house. You know, I'm going, what? And then I realized, and then it was hard, and I can't, there's no reality to that now because I have a bigger understanding. I've been on stage, you know, I still do 200 nights a year. So I can't play that, and I wasn't, that innocence and that of not knowing that. But I still, am open to whatever's happening in the moment.
God, but that's such a – no, very few people start off that way because that's such an honest – that is such a very honest, like you said, in the moment and real thing that you were going through that you expressed on stage, that if you had sat down and been like, okay, people want to hear about this. I'm going to write these jokes and see how they go, and then some of them will work and some of them. But that's just such a, I guess I got to stand on stage and figure this out, and that's what you were experiencing in the moment. And I think part of what people were picking up on was the authenticity of that moment,
right?
Because it was real. Like that was real, and on some level, that was resonating with their molecules that you were having that moment on stage, and that's really fucking funny.
It is, and all comedy is kind of relatable. When you write your comedy, if this is something that really tickles your funny bone and you think this is ridiculous and you're really saying it and you really believe it, you know, I think that the audience hooks into you. And the fact that I was this scared, terrified, but I love that fear, you know, and I still love it, and I go for it today. I'm still a fan. I'm in my 60s, and I love – anytime I can go to an amusement park, I die to go to an amusement park. And when I'm working around – you know, anytime there's a roller coaster, I want to go on every roller coaster. I love that, and that's the analogy. I look to – the higher it is, the scarier it is, the closer you think you're coming to death – the more your adrenaline pumps. And when somebody, when I walk out on stage and, you know, obviously after, you know, 40 years in the business, I have a plethora of material and voices and things to draw from. But if I could be taken off the beaten path, if something could go wrong, you know, technically, or there's a noise in the audience or something is happening in that moment, that is such joy, that gives me such joy. And the worst moments turn into the best moments. You know, I talk about, and I think you know this as a comic, you know, the glass is always half empty. So you can have a room that is roaring, but one person has a sour face.
And you focus right on that one person.
That's it.
What's that guy's problem?
Right. It becomes about that. Not the fact that 6,000 people are screaming and laughing and having the night. And they're not aware because this person is facing you. And that happened to me one night where I just went, you know, this one person and I'm looking and they're roaring and you've got to roll. And, you know, once you start them going, it doesn't matter what you say. It's like an engine of laughter and hilarity and excitement. And I'm in the throes of it. And there's this one guy who's not making any eye contact with me. He's not looking at me and he's just kind of sitting there and he's looking off in another direction. Like he looks like, what the fuck am I doing here? Why did you bring me here? So finally, I just, like an idiot, because
I have a bad feeling about it.
Yeah, I went, hey, stop, everybody, stop. I know you're having
a good
time.
Stop the momentum of the show.
Yeah, stop. Can I just say something? I'm going to stop right here. The guy here with the blue sweater in front, who is not looking at me, who doesn't seem to enjoy myself.
Oh, no.
What the fuck is up with you? What the fuck is up with you? Yeah. And you got it. The lady beside him goes, he's blind. And I said, what? Like an idiot. I heard it because I didn't know what. She goes,
but
he's blind.
That had to turn into one of the best moments of the show.
Wait. So I go, he's blind. And you could hear a group, like a massive gasp. And it just sucking from a moment of, it was like a nuclear holocaust of comedy just sucked out of the room, right? He's blind. Why did you fuck up? Why'd you have to stop? And he's not smiling, and she's going like, you stopped the whole show and you put this this light on us, and like, and it was just quiet. And I said that. I said, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I don't know. This is like, you just sucked the comedy out of the room. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. But can I ask a question? And I was serious. I go, why the fuck would you pay for front row tickets for a blind man? You could put him in the fucking balcony and tell him it's the front row. He wouldn't think the same. And that turned, in that minute, that could have gone either way.
Yes.
But that came out of my discomfort, out of my fear, out of reality. I shared with the audience how uncomfortable I was. I think the audience felt equally as uncomfortable as me. And in that moment, and that adrenaline and that fear and that rejection was so, to bring it back, to drop into that deep hole, that's like that first little huge drop that you have at a roller coaster. I felt that, on stage. And I go for those moments all the time.
Well,
I don't
look
to embarrass anybody. But
no, of course not. But I think when people go to a comedy show, they want, and this is why it's so difficult to shoot comedy for, you know, to, like for television.
Right.
Because it's such an intimate communal experience. And I think when people go to a comedy show, they just want to be a part of something. They want to be a part of that ride. And so, you know, a lot of my set is riffing with the audience. And sometimes it's hard to follow the riffs with stuff that I've written, because the riffs are about the experience that we're all having, and the written stuff is about experiences that I've just had.
Right.
And so it can be challenging sometimes to just make sure that people feel as included as possible, because that's what they want. And that's a moment.
Well, in the 80s,
they all had it together.
In the 80s, I did a show called Howiewood. I think it was a Showtime special, actually. But it was in the round. And obviously, when you prepare for these specials, you do, you know, an extensive amount of preparation. And, you know, I had my hour. I had my new hour. The piece that, to this day, I get texted, emailed, tweeted about is, and it's my favorite part of the show. So it's Theater in the Round. And this woman, in the middle of my act, gets up to go to the ladies' room. I mean, she got up. I assume to go to the ladies. She got up and I watched her as I'm talking and performing. I watched her leave, go up the aisle and leave. The door closed. So in the middle, and this is what I just got off the aisle. I just thought, this is the round. It looks the same no matter where you turn. So I'm going to just stop my act for a minute. Are you with the lady that left? Yeah, you are. Okay, let me take, and it took forever. Let me take the 50 people in this area. Get 50 people in this area. Stand up. Walk across the stage, go over here, let me mix you up. Let's take 50 people here. So nobody looks the same. And then I moved, I just shuffled everybody so that when she came down that aisle, nothing would be recognizable. And I told the audience that, and I said, listen, I'm going to be doing my act. I will give you a signal where I will hit the mic twice, you know, that I see her coming in the door. Just don't let her know that we're focusing on her. But let's just continue to laugh and watch what happens. I promise you this is going to be great. If it doesn't make the special, it's just great. This is much more
right.
What I'm into. And we'll talk about that because I'm into candid camera more than any other thing, more than stand-up or anything. But she comes down the aisle. The door opens. I'm doing my act. She comes down the aisle, and you see her walk to her aisle. She looks down the aisle. She doesn't see any face that looks remotely like anybody she knows. She looks at her ticket. And then she turns around, she goes back up the aisle, and the door closes. The audience roars. Within 30 seconds, another door opens on the circle, and the same lady, looking at her ticket, comes down the aisle, is looking up and down the aisle, and then goes back up and disappears in the door. And you watch over the course – it doesn't last this long on the special, but you could still see it on the special. It was over the course of the next 20 minutes. She had gone in and come out every door and walked down, looked at her ticket, and walked down. And to this day, she still writes me. She emails me. This is like 1989. She said that she was pregnant at the time, and she, you know, her bladder was, you know,
sure,
full constantly. And she'll never forget. That kid is probably, you know, almost 40 years old, 30 years old now that she had. But people go, you're the lady that walked up and down the aisle.
How did you let on? Did you finally go, okay, I was just screwing with you?
Okay, so at a certain point, I think that's in the special, she came down. The joke was over after seven times. But yeah, if it's over after seven times, me always wants it to go 14 times.
Right.
Because I like it to be over. Then not funny,
and then,
then obnoxious,
funny again. Yeah.
Then it's funny.
Yeah.
But you gotta wade through that shit. So finally, when it was obnoxious or past that, I just said, can I just stop the show? And she was like at her wit's end. She's in a thing. I go, ma'am, I'm trying to do a fucking concert here, and you keep interrupting, coming up and down the aisle. She goes, I can't find my husband. And then we sat her down, but I gave into her, and she got a big hand, and it was kind of a nice thing.
Oh, that's
thing.
Fun.
But to me, that's funnier than any material. I was, you know, as a kid, I've always felt like a misfit, and I talk about my entree into comedy was, my memory is, there's always a lot of laughter in my house. And my parents used to stay up and watch Jack Parr and Johnny Carson, and I'd hear laughter. But I was like 4 or 5 years old, and when I'd sit down, I'd run in because they were laughing, and I'd watch what they were watching, and it didn't connect. I didn't really understand. Like if somebody talked about a mother-in-law, I didn't even know what a mother-in-law you're for.
Right.
What is a mother-in-law? What's a mother-in-law joke? It means nothing. And my mom and dad would be laughing. And one particular time, I was probably 5 years old, on a Sunday night, he's my hero, Alan Funt, had a show called Candid Camera.
Of course.
And that's the beginning of all this hidden camera and punk that we see today, but that was the beginning of it. Didn't know this. So I sit down with them. They're watching it. It's Sunday night. And he explains to the audience, I'm going to hire people. I'm going to hire this young lady who's going to think that she's a receptionist. And her only job is to answer the phone every time it rings and we have a desk set up. But let me show you something. We've tied a rope to the legs of the desk. It drilled a hole in the wall. And on the other side of the wall, when she goes to reach for the phone, we're going to pull the rope and the desk is going to go away from under her. Now, as a little kid, I understood this was like a little surprise party. I know what's going to happen. And that anticipation was so exciting. And it was so, and we were just sitting there, and me and my mom and my dad, we all knew that something funny, we were in on the joke. Nobody else on TV was in on the joke. The girl sits down, the phone rings, they pull the rope. Her jaw drops like, what the fuck just happened? And it was the funniest thing. It's not a joke. It's not, it is a setup, but the punchline was real human, awkward, kind of discomfort.
Right.
And I learned that discomfort was my sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, even now in comedy, any awkward story, any uncomfortable is my sweet spot. I love that. And it's very relatable. What I didn't understand at the time is that you need an audience and a TV show to create that. Oh, the phone is
ringing. Hello. All right, hello, you're calling in.
Hi, I just wanted to pledge $0.
Great, we're still at $0 on the pledge board, trying to hit $1 our goal.
I think they're actually calling in to correct the NCIS names that were given
we're
by
still
the first
waiting
caller.
For someone to call that in. Apparently no one knows. We've been waiting all day for someone to call in and give us the NCIS. The phone lines are open. No one has called in yet to give us the correct answer. And we're going to keep working. We'll wait. You know what? Maybe they'll call back and maybe we'll find out who these people are who are on NCIS. I don't know. It's tough to say at this point. But I love hearing you talk about discomfort because the same mechanism that powers – the same battery that powers your comedy, which is discomfort – also has the sort of dark side because it's tied to your personality, but the discomfort you felt that 10 million New Yorkers hadn't come see you, that is also a part of that same battery, you know, where you're like, oh, it's only 15,000 people. Like, the glass half empty thing is part of your discomfort battery.
Well, I've always been an outcast, you know, like when I was a kid, I've been open about my mental health issues, but I suffer from anxiety and depression. And so I was always just trying to make myself laugh. Laughter was my bridge to existing. And it had nothing to do with, I didn't believe there was a career. I didn't even entertain a career idea in my, it's just what I did. And if somebody got mad at me because of something that I did, you know, before Caddyshack, way before Caddyshack, and I talked about this on stage, you know, I didn't want to go swimming in the swimming pool at school. So I threw a chocolate bar in the pool, you know, because
it looks like a turd.
Yeah. But when I went once, I always go too far. When everybody came and heard that somebody had shit in the pool, I dived in and came up with it in my mouth.
Sure.
And got asked to leave the school. But then I wanted to meet girls. I didn't know how to meet girls. I said, I want to join a team. I was in high school, I was 4'11" and 89 pounds. The only team I could get on was the wrestling team for wrestling under 90. Now, here's a guy who doesn't want to shake hands. But I thought, if I got a uniform, I'm going to meet girls. I didn't realize the uniform was like a onesie. It was a girl's bathing suit, a one-piece. That's that picture right there. I can't show
you. Oh, my God. That's you?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Me. But I was 89 pounds. I was
the flowing locks of hair.
Did I not look like a little girl with knee pads?
Cascading off. There's a movie called Sleepaway Camp, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but that reminds me of Sleepaway Camp.
I look exactly like Finn from Stranger Things.
A bit, yeah, you do. You do look a bit, a little bit. Although facially you do, but the mane of hair that's cascading out of your head is unbelievable. And he's got the knee pads on.
Well, you know,
he's got the wrestling gear on.
Speaking of that, so the only way I could meet girls, like, I wasn't shaving, my voice didn't change, I'm 89 pounds, nobody would talk to me. I'm going to admit it on your show, but I could walk into the ladies' room and just stand at the mirror and brush my hair. So I go, hi, so what's your name? You know, Terry.
Howina.
No, I didn't have to raise my voice. My voice was not changed.
Sure.
So it was the only way I could talk to girls. I would stand in the girls' bathroom brushing my hair.
And you met a lot of people this way.
But I didn't, I couldn't make the transition from the girl they met in the bathroom to a date. That was a tough, I could talk to them.
You had a lot of lesbian relationships in those days.
I probably could have, but I didn't. I had no, I'm so socially awkward. And to this day, incredibly socially awkward. I just have figured out.
Well, a lot of comics are, and especially with, you know, anxiety, depression stuff, and which I'm very intimately familiar with. And, that when people go, but you're a comedian, how you go, yeah, but when you're a comic, you're in control of it. And when you just walk into a social situation, you're not in control of that. And that is unsettling, you know. But to have a microphone, you're directing the action of the room. So I think a lot of comics are actually the same way. They can be very
right. Well, on a
person.
Stage with a microphone is not intimate at all. You know, it's not you're it's an audience.
Right.
And when it gets intimate, it's uncomfortable. And that's the blind man. That's like what if it's one on one. But for the most part, it's not even if you are talking to somebody who is, you know, you're riffing with somebody, it's still not intimate. You have a light in your eye and that's it. But if you're in a quiet room without an audience, kind of like we're doing right now and talking to somebody under the guise of a podcast, that's easier than just if somebody just showed up. I don't go to parties.
Right.
And I don't go. It's really tough for me, you know, and I'm incredibly medicated even right now as we speak.
And just it helps take the edge off.
I'm alive and I'm here and I'm, you know.
But a lot of people now, and I don't know if it's just that more people experience OCD and anxiety and depression now, or if it's just more diagnosed now, but I do believe that the world is such a... That we're so much more aware of everything that's going on in the world that I think that more people develop anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder as a response to a very seemingly toxic, uncontrollable world. I mean, it is a very
you give something a title like OCD, I don't know that you can develop OCD. I think OCD is something that is maybe genetic, maybe I don't know. I haven't cracked it yet, but you can develop, you know, mental health. You know, ultimately all we want to do as human beings is cope. So I think with what's happening now in the world and with social media and with, you know, just that we're open to everywhere, there's everything and you can't hide. I think that people need more coping skills right now.
Sure.
You know, the news cycle is huge. It's 24/7 and everything's breaking and everything's on the precipice of ending.
God,
and
that's all I could think about when you were talking about, because I remember the days when TV would sign off and just thinking now, like, boy, what would people do now if they couldn't have like a 24-hour news cycle? It was just like, fuck off, go to bed. Well, but what's going on in the world? That not your business right now. Go to bed.
But because it's 24 hours and because that's a business.
Yeah.
They have to make everything breaking and
sensational.
But you use the word sensational. But if you're kind of in, you know, mentally fragile, this sensation is not healthy.
Right.
You know, and even like headlines and even what you read in print, it's a scary world out there. And it's really hard to go ahead.
I was going
to
say they present it because they know that people are more motivated to watch things when they think their life is in danger
right.
than just like, oh, here's some things that happened today. Don't worry. You know, they know that it's more motivating. We're like, is everything in your house going to kill you? You need to watch this. Oh, here, you know, we might be at war. Oh, this is the worst. This person, you know, it's such a, and it's sort of driven by the kind of, you know, the capitalism of the media just trying to get traffic and eyes and whatever. And so they know that scaring the shit out of people or taking the most extreme points of view.
And even the way it's presented by, even if it is a headline, it's now more, and it doesn't matter what way you're leaning, you know how the broadcaster is leaning.
Right.
And that kind of adds, that heightens whatever it is that you're reacting to, you know, whereas Walter Cronkite or when I was a kid, you know, they were newsreaders,
right.
you know, and then I could discern, give me all the facts. And I'll discern how I'll, you know, make my way through this.
I was just picturing Walter Cronkite going, and here's the news tonight. Well, the libs are at it again.
Right. Never. So that's exactly, and it's no better in the left leaning.
No. It's of just like,
but that's how you got to sell. But they realize that we as customers glom onto a personality, and we glom onto the way somebody is envisioning something rather than just a news. We won't listen to facts and try to discern for ourselves. We want somebody to do it for us, to feel, to tell us how we're supposed to feel.
Right.
It's more than just the facts.
Yeah. Well, and again, in that case, it's still the same thing as going to a comedy club. People just want community, and they want to watch stuff and go, yeah, that's what I already believed. Yeah, I'm doubling down. Yeah. You know, like they just... We all just want to connect, and we all just want those experiences. But but for people who, because I think a lot of people who listen to the podcast probably, if they don't have mental health stuff that they deal with, they have certainly grazed it, or it's near them in their lives. You know, what are some of the coping mechanisms? Like, what have you discovered?
The main coping mechanism for everybody, and you're saying people listen to the podcast, they might have had some experience with it. I don't think this is my thing. My whole soapbox is to remove the stigma. I think if you're a human being, you've had a mental health issue.
Absolutely.
And whether that mental health issue is bearing a child and becoming a parent and bearing the pressure of becoming a parent for the first time, breaking up with somebody, losing somebody, you know, loss, the pressure of work, the pressure of, as I explained, of not fitting in. There's nothing in place in part of our curriculum that gives us as human beings coping skills. You know, you go, I always say, we'll take care of our dental health. When nothing hurts, you'll go twice a year, three times a year to the dentist for a cleaning, a checkup, for x-rays. And they go, you know, look, mom, no cavities. There's nothing wrong. There is nothing in place for somebody that seems to be getting along, for somebody to ask you maybe a few questions and see what your reaction is, and then based on your reaction, maybe make a recommendation of maybe you do need some counseling or help or coping skills. And whether that coping skill is just take a breath, you know, breathe through your anger, whatever it is, or, you know, or just to let you know that the way you feel is okay.
Right.
You know, and other people feel, because in our own minds, it's very lonely and it's very insular, and everybody believes that nothing is. And that's the answer to, for me, I'm not being political here, but there's big, you know, talk about gun control every time something horrible happens. And, you know, I'm not a proponent of guns by any means, but I think that anything that happens, you know, and then you talk to the people that surrounded the perpetrator, there's been red flags their whole lives, and there's nothing in place to really, you know, douse this before somebody becomes armed and dangerous.
Right.
I mean, these are all young kids who have had, and I'm not giving them an excuse. It's us as society. We aren't taking care of business. When we enter school, you know, there's a school nurse, but there's nobody in the curriculum that is a bona fide psychologist.
I wonder if part of that is just because the idea of mental health is so delicate for people, that if a school psychologist counseled a child in some way, if their parents would be like, what the fuck? You're not allowed to. That's my kid. No, you can't. You know, everyone kind of has their own idea about what it is.
Right. But even the insurance companies, I've gotten talked on Capitol Hill, they don't mirror the same amount of funds for physical health as they do for mental health. There's no problem. You know, it's really funny. If somebody says, my back hurts, I don't think I can lift today, everybody's got a card of their chiropractor.
Right.
But if somebody said, you know, I just... the mood, I just can't really function today, or I don't want to go to work. Nobody hands you their psychiatrist. I mean, maybe here in LA and New York, but in middle America, that's just not the norm. And medical doctors, it's tried and proven. If two people have surgery, the exact same surgery, but somebody's mental state is they just want to let go, they won't heal as fast. The mind over matter is a real thing. And if we could create healthy minds and take care of our minds, our physical health would, you know, I would imagine a good portion of everybody's bad back is mental.
Well, and I also think that sort of what you were saying, the stigma around it, if we can destigmatize it so that people aren't afraid to ask for help, or not embarrassed to ask for help, or know that they can seek options, that there are other people out there. And thankfully, that's, you know, where the internet is can be a big positive, is that anyone can connect to other people
the way in a way that they couldn't when we were growing up, where you just kind of had to get lucky and either have, you know, the right parents or the right person in your neighborhood or the right person in your school. But it, you know, that's why I like talking about this stuff so casually on the podcast, because it just kind of makes people listening, if they're on the fence, go, oh, okay, well, I'm not broken. I just have a thing, and lots of people have things, and it's okay to go talk about it. It's okay to figure out, you know, how to kind of process this. Even if you don't feel like, oh, I need a therapist, the ability to talk to someone without judgment who's just going to be there to listen and offer some suggestions, you know, for the state of your, you know, for the sake of your mental well-being is beneficial, even if you don't feel like you have this big issue to deal with.
You know, my analogy is, you know, if you get hurt in any way physically, you know, you should, you know, you put Neosporin on it and you flush it out and you wash it and you get, if you have any mental wound, and that's like somebody hurting you, hurting your feelings or whatever, you know, we have a tendency in our society to think that the best thing to do is to bury it and suppress it. But like an open wound, like a cut, wash it, clean it out. And right. The way we clean out a, you know, a mental wound is, at first, if anything, talk about it. You know, just talk. Just and there's, I do this thing in Canada for Bell.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Let's talk.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
That.
So and that's the campaign, and it's just about talking, and it's not about going to a psychiatrist, and it's not about going to a therapist, and it's not about taking medication. The first step is what you're doing right now on the podcast, is just talk. And maybe there's one person listening to go, you know, it's not so bad that I'm depressed or that I can't function. It's kind of normal, just like it's as normal to say I have a headache.
Right.
These are normal facets of being human. If you don't ever suffer, if you can go through a whole life and not ever be depressed, not ever be anxious, not ever feel like you can't cope, not ever feel like you're at a loss.
You might be a sociopath.
You're right. I mean, that's the bigger problem.
Yeah.
But everybody's afraid to admit their humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, because we're, you know, we've been conditioned to think that any weakness is bad. It separates us from the pack. It makes us not a viable member. And it's all bullshit. The most human thing to do is to connect with other people. Everyone, again, unless someone is a complete sociopath, if you walk into a room full of people, 98% of them, when they walked in, it's very likely they were like, oh, I feel kind of awkward. I feel kind of weird. Like, right. Everyone feels that way.
Right.
Everyone feels that way. And the people who say that they don't are very likely posturing because they just don't want to.
But that's why our comedy works. Because we, just by virtue of what we do, we mention these little weaknesses and discomforts and things like that. And what they're laughing at is, yes, it's funny, but it's also relatable. If it's not relatable at all, you won't get the laugh. But that awkward, uncomfortable weirdness is what people relate to, and that's what makes us all one, and that's what makes us, each of us, unique too, you know, is those feelings.
Right. Well, it also gives the audience a bit of a release. Oh, okay, I'm not the only one, you know. And again, that goes back to forming the community of people who know that they're not alone, you know. Oh, they've noticed that too. Or even if you're talking about something that you've done, they can either laugh at you because, you know, you're putting yourself in a sort of a subjugated position. They go, oh, that guy down there is kind of an idiot. But for a lot of it, it's, oh, I've done that too. Oh,
well,
I get
that's
that
how you know, that's what turned me around. I talked about it in my book. I've talked about it before. Maybe you know the story, but I was on Howard Stern in early 90s. Was the first time I ever talked about this, you know. And I was on with, you know how he has a couple of guests on.
Yeah.
Not like you, who just has one.
This is one.
So nice. Yeah. Just one. But he had the guy on that did Puppetry of the Penis.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
And the guy was sitting beside me, and he's able to take his penis and
turn into a watch and all sorts of stuff.
Great characters. It's a character piece. I'm not into theater as much as some people, but
he's the Carrot Top of cock play. Basically,
there he is.
Yes.
So, and they finished with him first, and I was fixated because of my germaphobe and OCD on the fact that this guy's touching his dick, and then there's no wet naps, there's nothing, and then he leaves, and I see him grab the handle of the door.
Oh no!
And he leaves, and the whole rest of the interview, I'm fixated on the doorknob, thinking, when I leave, how am I going to touch this doorknob? It was the summer. I had short sleeves on. I couldn't pull down my sleeve. And that's, anyway, it seems like an eternity. And then finally I hear Howard go, well, thanks, Howie. Thanks for coming by. And I go over to the door and I want to try to open it and I can't figure it out. And I said, does somebody have a tissue? And they go, what do you need a tissue for? I said, well, I like the handle. The guy touched it with he touched his dick and he touched the handle. I don't want to touch the handle. So Howard, they decided to play. They go, open the door. I go, I'm not going to touch the door. You touch the door. I went and found the Kleenex. They took the Kleenex away from me. So I went to take my shirt out of my pants. They held that and they were going, just touch the door. I really have OCD and I started having a panic attack and I thought I was going to have a heart attack and I couldn't breathe. And out of just desperation, I said, Howard, all kidding aside, I have obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm medicated. I am going to drop and have to be taken to the hospital right now if you don't open the fucking door. And he went, I'm sorry. Okay. And that was the first time. This is like in the beginning of the 90s. And so he opens the door and I walk out in the hall. And as I walk out in the hall, I hear on the speakers, we were still broadcasting. So this whole thing was on the air. Yeah. So I, you know, and this is the early 90s. And you talk about stigma. So the stigma is there, or it's the late 90s. This stigma, at least for me, as somebody who's, you know, my age, I was born in the 50s, I hear, oh my shit, I said this on the air. My life is over. Number one, this is a national radio program. My kids, who at that time are in school, are going to be so embarrassed that their father just admitted on national radio that he's a mental case. Number two, I'm never going to be able to get a job again because I know that, you know, there's millions of dollars in every production. Why are they going to hire somebody who's got a mental health issue to be part of their production? That's in my mind.
And that's where the OCD is now focusing on that.
Well, and then I thought that this is just embarrassing. This is the end of the world. And I could feel a physical drop in such depression. I just didn't want to go on. And I remember walking down that hall like dead men walking, got into the elevator, down the elevator in Manhattan. And I was in the lobby heading out onto the street. I could see all the traffic and the teams of people. I never felt more alone in my life. And I thought, like, what do I do? What do I do? Maybe I'll just run into traffic. And I walk out onto the street and I'm about just getting my breath. My head is down. And some guy comes up into my periphery and he says, just beside me, he goes, are you Howie Mandel? And I go, yes. He goes, I just heard you on Howard Stern. And I feel my heart drop into my stomach and thinking that's it. And he whispered, this has different meaning now, but in my ear, he goes, me too. And I go, what? He goes, no, I have OCD. And that was so nice to hear somebody, you know, I suffer all the time. And we started talking and it was the first time I thought, well, you too, I'm not alone. It wasn't even big. Emails weren't big then. And I started getting mail, you know, and saying thank you for talking about it and doing it. And it was the first time I realized there's like a community of humanity that is suffering like me and I'm not alone and I shouldn't be embarrassed.
And no one had talked about it before.
And nobody had ever talked about it. And there was a time, had I not had that moment, I wouldn't have this discussion with you right now. Never. I would never. You got to think like I'm that happy, crazy, silly guy that's on stage and not have any sense of who I am or how I feel or how I function.
But isn't it interesting that that goes back to the thing you were talking about when you pointed out the blind guy on stage, that a lot of times the things that we think are catastrophic mistakes can be flipped because they're very special, real, authentic moments?
Well, I'll give you one other one that might ring true for you. So in 2005, I was kind of in a bad depression and my career was really waning. And I got a call from NBC and they said, we want you to host a game show. And I said, fuck no. And I hung up the phone. Now, you have to realize that in 2005, if you really go and look, no comedians had hosted game shows.
It used to feel like the kiss of death. Like, this is the end of my career. I'm hosting a game show now.
Right.
That's how it used to be.
And as somebody who trades on irony, the game show host was the punchline.
Right.
Right. And as Pat Sajak would say, and I'm not saying Pat Sajak is a joke, but that was the joke. You'd act like a game show host. It was the nail in the coffin of a career. So I went, no fucking way. Within 15 minutes, they call me back and they say, no, Howie, there's this format that is really big all over the world and NBC has bought it. And NBC is saying that they want to do it every night in succession for 1 week. At that time, that has never happened, where they hadn't given an hour of prime time to one show for a whole week. So I went, no, No. So you're telling me the nail is going in the coffin of my career. You want to hit it in every fucking night of a week.
Seven nails.
Goodbye. And I hung up the phone again. The third time they call back, they go, can he just show you the game? I said, you know what? I don't even want to go anywhere. I'm at Jerry's Deli deep in the valley. If he wants to come and show me the game, let him come show me the game. So this guy named Rob Smith from Endemol comes out to the valley. I just showed you.
Yep.
He made out of, what do you call that, art paper? Like a, he just cut cards.
Yeah, he cut out. I saw it's in the hallway. It's like all the pieces with it. It's,
right, but he made it himself. He didn't go to Kinko's. None of the lines are straight, nothing. He shows up at Jerry's. He puts this card down, and he shows me the game. And he tells me, there's going to be 26 bikini models, and you're going to say open the – I said, but it's just – what's a, is there trivia? No. Is there a skill? No. Is there, what is the, like, there's no game. He goes, well, we can't do it without you. We think you're perfect. So I go home and I tell my wife, and she goes, why don't you want to do it? I said, because it's going to put a nail in the coffin of my career. She goes, Howie, you were just at Jerry's by yourself eating soup, and now you're at home. This is your career. Take the fucking deal. So I called him back. I called him back and I said, I'll do it. And they said, when do you need me? They said, we tape Monday. This is a Friday. This is like my St. Elsewhere story. I go, well, don't you have to build a set? They go, no, we built a set. I go, well, don't you have to hire the women? They go, we hired the women. So now I'm thinking, how far down the rung of people they needed? How many people have said no that I'm available on Friday at 4 o'clock for a show that's taping on Monday? But regardless. So I said to them, can I hire some of my friends? Maybe we can do comedy, because I was hearkening back to the only comedians I know that did game shows were Johnny Carson and Groucho Marx.
Right.
At the time.
Right.
You know, not at my time. At the, you know, before that, I couldn't. And Groucho Marx was really funny. I hired some of my comedian friends, and we came up with, like, real funny lines. And it was going to be funny, and this is what I would do, and this is how I'd fill the time, and I'd take a break. And they let me do that, and I wrote that. The first day, and I have the picture here, the first day, and I'll never forget, I did 500 episodes of Deal or No Deal. I'm on the set. They go, Deal or No Deal. The crowd roars. Ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel. I walk out and I walk up to the very first contestant. Her name is Karen Van. Okay. And I have a picture of her and I'll never forget this. And I was going to be, I look at her in the eyes and I say, tell me about yourself. And she says, my name's Karen Van. I have three boys. They're right here. And there's three young children, beautiful boys sitting in the audience. I've never had health insurance. She's never owned a house. You know, she has no money. She just lost her job. And I'm thinking, you know, first and foremost, I'm a human being. And this person is standing in front of me telling me she has nothing. And at the time, $1 million, even today, and outside of L.A., she could walk away with $1 million. And I'm looking at her, and you know this, Chris. You've been on the set and the wall and everything with people who aren't on TV. There seems to be a glaze that goes over people where you can tell sure. They're not, you know, they've never been on TV.
It's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. And you could see that overwhelming feeling in somebody's eyes. So I said, she's not really focusing. And, you know, she picked the first cases, and then the banker calls, and the banker says the offer's $20,000. And this is where I got my cadence. I said, she's not listening to me. I'm not going to do the routine that I had planned, because that'll pull focus to that. And she's in this other world that she better take this offer. And I changed my cadence to, you know, Karen, the banker wants to give you $20,000, you know? And it created drama, but the drama was, you better take this.
Right.
You know, deal or no deal. And I realized that, you know, and she was just having a good time, and then no deal. And with the, you know, she's going to show me, she's not going to take 20 grand, you know? And I felt like, oh my God. And it made me more serious and made me more empathetic. You know, it became about her. This girl is digging a hole, not only for her, for these three boys sitting behind her. She's turning down all this fucking money. She ended up turning it down all the way. She went home with 5 grand, which is good, but not great.
Right.
And it was because, and I was so embarrassed. I did all these shows. I didn't do any of my comedy. I just, for the first time ever on television, I became Howie Mandel. And it was just about, I just want you to do as good as possible. And that's all it was. And I was so embarrassed after I taped the 5 shows. I got Terry, my wife, and we got on a plane and I flew way out to the Caribbean. I didn't want to be anywhere near where this aired. I was so embarrassed. I was a comic who wasn't working that much, who just became a game show host, who did not one thing funny. And I was just trying to get people to walk away with more money. That was my only goal. I just want you to change your life. And the first day it aired, Rob called me and goes, you're not going to believe the ratings. And the next day, the ratings went up and it became this phenomenon. And I landed back in Miami, and within 30 seconds, somebody looked at me and went, deal or no deal. And that became my catchphrase. Nothing has changed my career more, and nothing has given me more success than Deal or No Deal. Like, beyond doing, people who watched Bobby's World knew Bobby's World. People who watched St. Elsewhere knew St. Elsewhere. People who watched HBO knew me as a stand-up comic. This is the first thing that brought all those audiences together. And it was the first time that, and I thought it was the most embarrassing thing, is the thing I didn't want to do, is the thing I could tell you honestly, I did nothing for but be myself, but being a human being and wearing my heart on the sleeve. You know, they always ask me to do Hollywood Game Night at NBC, and I can't. And I tell them the same reason, I can't do it, because that is about, you know, a real person will be sitting on the couch and celebrities are playing games, but we have to be entertaining and goofy. And I said, I'm so afraid that if I do something goofy or entertaining, I'll pull the focus. They'll make a wrong decision or not get the answer. And if they lose $100 because my heart will break.
I did Hollywood Game Night and thankfully we won, but I understand what you're saying. But also just that idea of being in the moment feels like every time you've been honest with who you are, whether it was the wait, or the Howard Stern thing, or Deal or No Deal, it has worked out in your favor, and it seems like the lesson is don't be afraid to be yourself. And you're also not the best judge of how people are going to perceive
but
you.
But my lesson in my life lesson is from Nike, and it's just do it, and it's do it without thought. Because anytime I think about anything, it doesn't work out as well as the thing. You know, if you overthink it, if I had gone with my gut, like my thinking, I would not do these things. If I didn't know I was auditioning for St. Elsewhere, you know what I mean? I just did it and I showed up and I got that. My gut told me don't do Deal or No Deal because I overthought what it would do to my
brain. Was that your gut or was that your brain? That might have been your brain.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't tell the difference between my gut and my brain, and that's the issue. But the thing is, you're right. I don't know what I'm saying, but I just say yes, and I just do it. And nothing that has worked out for me has been anything that I've overthought.
Right.
Right? And the one time I did overthink, it was the wrong decision to not do Deal. And my wife, who did the thinking for me, made me do the right thing. But that came out of, you said, the things that you're most embarrassed about and the things those are the things. I was so humiliated that I had done 5 hours of network television just trying to get people to better their lives.
It also, and I think this is, you know, a lot of young comics go through this where they're trying to write comedy or do a thing that they think the audience wants to see, like we were talking about. And then at a certain point, they might just accidentally say something that really happened and people laugh and they go, oh, that's not funny. That's just my life. Like, no, that you're the thing. You're the thing that's funny, not some idea. Some image that you're trying to put into the world, that's fake. That's right. Fake. What's real, and that's why, and I think especially for people who maybe suffer from anxiety or depression or anyone ever, but the idea that we think we have to feel something in order to be doing something is false. The truth is, when you're just being as opposed to trying to do, I think that's where the magic happens, and that's where, as a performer, you're just trying to shrink that barrier between yourself and yourself on stage and yourself and the, you know, and the more yourself you are, just being yourself, that's what people connect with. It's not like, oh, I wrote all these killer jokes, you know.
It's humility and humanity.
Yeah.
You know, is the most relatable thing.
And mental health over dental health. What, guys, huh? Who's with me?
Drop the mic.
Any callers on the ring? Anyone on the, did we find out who the NCIS people were? What'd you say?
I don't know.
Mark Harmon, Polly
Perrette. Oh, Polly Perrette. Yeah.
Oh, she just left, right?
Yeah. Anyway, hello, you're calling into the podcast.
Yeah, I don't. How come you didn't know that NCIS was Polly Perrette and David McCollum and then Sean Murray and Michael Weatherly and Brian Dietzen and Rocky Carroll and Corte de Pablo and Emily Wickersham and Lauren Holly and Sasha Alexander.
Oh my God, you're so right. I'm so sorry. I missed all those things. I apologize. I can see by the board. We still have raised $0. $1 was the goal. We haven't hit it yet, but I feel confident that we're going to hit that $1 goal at some point, Howie. We're going to hit it.
Really?
Maybe.
You're such a positive person. You know what they say? Less is more. And especially when I'm trying to raise money on your podcast, apparently less is more.
But isn't it funny? It's, you know, and then just sort of wrapping this up, I want, and boy, there's so many things. I wanted to talk to you about the Tonight Show as well. I wish I could talk to you for 3 hours. Will you please, can I please have you on the podcast again?
I would love to come back.
Because I adore you, and I also feel very connected to you in the sense that when you talk about, because people think of you as a very affable, fun, you know, positive guy, and I think some people think of me as that too, and sometimes I'll say to them like, yes, because sometimes I fight so hard at the dark feelings inside that I think I'm, that's why I want to put so much positivity into the world, because I don't want people to feel this way. I feel like I sometimes try harder, maybe to the annoyance of people, to throw, you know, like, well, hey, you can do it, support positivity.
On one final note, but that's the thing. You know, people don't realize, they'll go, that's too dark or too soon. Comedy is dark.
Yes.
Comedy is negative. It really is. It's the sense of humor, which I believe most people don't have a sense of humor.
Right.
Just because you laugh at a joke doesn't give you a sense of humor.
It means you like comedy. It means you like to laugh.
Right. But the sense, find the sense where there isn't comedy. And even in its purest form, if you laughed at a clown falling down at the circus, you're laughing at the misfortune of this weird-looking guy.
This poor, multicolored man with a silly nose.
Right, but that's not empathetic. That's sad. When you hear a joke that two guys walk into a bar, what you're waiting for is something disastrous to happen to one of them so you can laugh.
Right.
You know, so laughter always comes out of negative. And whether it's a horrible story that happened to you that you turned funny, or you're pointing out the
idiosyncrasies,
yeah, but which is probably fine. There's a guy on AGT right now that has Tourette's, you know,
he's a really great comic.
But that's my point, and my point is, you could say you shouldn't make fun of that, you don't make, and he can. And he does, and he makes us comfortable, but he makes his Tourette's feel like any inability we might have to do something. So that's what we relate to. So that's never too soon. It's too soon for somebody that doesn't have a sense of humor. It's never too dark. It's too dark for somebody that doesn't have a sense of humor.
Right.
But amongst comedians, we could sit and talk about anything. Sometimes when you go out into the public, because not everybody has a great sense of humor, you have to curb that.
Sure, sure. Well, inside, just like you said, inside all comedy is the seed of something tragic, because it's a coping. That is a coping mechanism, and it's also a bit of armor, and it also empowers us when we have the ability to stand and point and laugh at something that was horrible. We are ultimately saying we have power over this thing, because we can belittle it now, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether it's, you know, death or something terrible or some sort of, that it was, you know, it's very empowering to be able to. I went on stage days after my dad's funeral because I felt like I just needed to talk about it on
right.
stage, and I needed to get some power over it, you know, and that was incredibly incredibly healing for me to be
able
to.
Well, I got
to
say maybe we've never talked about this off air, but the darkest day of my life was the day I buried my father. And I have never laughed harder in my life at the things that were happening that day. You know, we found things that were so absurd, so dark, so horrible, but I was laughing myself in tears. And that was my panacea for depression. And laughter is always whatever. That's my, you know, that's my lifesaver. That's, I need it. So whether the audience laughs or not, I need to laugh, you know, and that's, that works.
So do what makes you happy. Discover who you are. Be authentic to you. Be, don't do. There's a lot of great little nuggets today, I have to say. And I hope that people, when are you performing next? If you do 200 nights a year, where are you performing next?
I don't know. In the next week or so. I think I'm in the New York area and Florida. I don't know where.
Where can people go to see your dates?
Are you to Howie
Mandel.com.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me in your office. And thank you for being so welcoming. And thanks for doing At Midnight when it was on. Our showrunner was also the guy who also worked on Deal or No Deal, Jack Martin.
Yep.
And
we share the director from Talking Dead.
Russell. Russell also directs. Hello, darling. This is Russell.
Yes.
Directing America's Got. Are you doing America's Got Talent again, darling? It'll be so great to have you.
That's He's fantastic. The best.
I love him.
Yes.
Yeah, and thanks for letting me fuck around with you guys on AGT again, because that is an absolute blast.
You're amazing. Amazing.
Thanks, man. And as always, the end. Enjoy your burrito.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.